half-hour of news from the Decatur area, and as is our practice, we will begin with some of the recent obituaries appearing in the Decatur Herald and Review. Charlotte Irene Conaway Lee, 75, of Bement, passed away at 1 p.m. on Tuesday, October 13th, in her residence, surrounded by her family. A graveside service to celebrate Charlotte's life will be held at 1 p.m. on Friday, that's tomorrow, October 16th, at Macon County Memorial Park Cemetery in Harristown, Illinois. The family will receive friends for a time of visitation tonight from 5 to 7 p.m. at the Dawson and Wyckoff West Wood Street Funeral Home. Memorial contributions may be made or directed to the First Christian Church of Bement. Pamela S. Hart, 43, of Decatur, passed away on Sunday, October 11th, in Decatur Memorial Hospital. A celebration of life to celebrate Pamela's life will be held at 2 p.m. Friday, that's tomorrow, October 16th, in Graceland Fairlawn Funeral Home. Memorial donations are recommended to or care of the Hart family. Dean Allen Russell Jr., 54, of Decatur, formerly of Mesa, Arizona, passed away at 7:28 a.m. on Tuesday, October 13th, in his residence. A graveside service to celebrate Dean's life will be held at 11:30 a.m. on Friday, that's tomorrow, October 16th, in Wheeler Cemetery. The family will receive friends for a time of visitation from 10 to 11 a.m. on Friday at Dawson and Wyckoff North Chapel. Memorial contributions may be directed to the Humane Society of Decatur and Macon County. Mary Ann Steiner, 74, of Moquegua, died October 13th in Moquegua Rehabilitation and Healthcare Center. Funeral services will be held at 1 p.m. Saturday, October 17th, in Sites Funeral Home in Moquegua. Visitation will be from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Saturday, October 17th, also in Sites Funeral Home. Burial will be in the Odd Fellows Cemetery in Moquegua. Memorials may be made to Moquegua Ambulance Service, Moquegua Lions Club, or Moquegua Business Association. Joyce C. Streight, and that's Streight, 88, of Decatur, passed away at 6:19 a.m. Wednesday, October 14th, at Hickory Point Christian Village in Forsyth. Funeral services will be held at 11 a.m. Saturday, October 17th, at Brentlinger and Earl Funeral Home in Decatur, with visitation from 9:30 a.m. until service time. Graveside service will be held at Graceland Cemetery in Decatur. Memorials may be made to the Grace United Methodist Church. The death of Randy Thaxton of Decatur, Illinois, also affectionately known as Coach Thaxton, was announced in the Decatur Herald and Review, though it gives no date. But service to celebrate his life will be held and a visitation from 5 to 7 p.m. on Friday, that's tomorrow, October 16th, at New Salem Baptist Church, 352 West Wood Street. A funeral service will be held Saturday at 11 a.m., that's October 17th, at New Salem Baptist Church. Burial will take place in Macon County Memorial Park in Harristown. Professional services have been entrusted to the Walker Funeral Service. Charlene Rose Van Vliet, 63, Decatur, died on Monday, August 12th. Service is scheduled for 11 a.m. Friday, that's tomorrow, at Graceland Fairlawn Funeral Home with a flight home ceremony. Visitation is tonight from 5 to 7 p.m., that's Thursday. Burial, and I'm assuming it's also at the funeral home. Burial will take place at Harper Ferry Cemetery in Palmer. Memorial donations should be directed to the Homeward Bound Pet Shelter. Timothy S. Kuhn, 45, of Cisco, passed away at 1:10 a.m. Monday, October 12th. Visitation will be held from 5 to 7 p.m. Friday, that's tomorrow, October 16th, at the Mackie Wright Funeral Home in Monticello. A funeral mass will be held at 10 a.m. on Saturday, October 17th, at the St. Philomena Catholic Church in Monticello, with the Father Bruce Lopez officiating. In lieu of flowers, memorial donations may be made to the American Heart Association or to the American Cancer Society. The family requests that casual attire be worn for the services. Woodrow Woody Fathery, I guess, F-A-T-H-E-R-E-E, Jr., 79, of Clinton, passed away at 9:08 a.m. October 10th at the Dr. John Warner Hospital in Clinton. Funeral service will be held at 10 a.m. Friday, tomorrow, October 16th, at Calvert Funeral Home in Clinton, with the Pastor Brian Fathery officiating. Private graveside services will be held on Monday, October 19th, at Memorial Park Cemetery in Clinton. Visitation will be from 5 to 7 p.m. this evening, Thursday, October 15th, at the funeral home. Memorials may be directed to the Woody Fathery Memorial Fund. Stephen Scott Gilman of Tampa, Florida, age 52, formerly of Decatur, went to be with his Savior on Saturday, October 10th. Private services will be held in Tampa, Florida. Lowell Eugene Jean Johnston, 85, of Shelbyville, died at 8:45 p.m. on Monday, October 12th, in his home with his family. Funeral service will be held at 11 a.m. Saturday, October 17th, in Howe & Yockey Funeral Home in Shelbyville, with the Reverend Jeremy West officiating. Visitation will be from 5 to 7 p.m. Friday, and also from 10 to 11 a.m. on Saturday. Burial will be in Glenwood Cemetery in Shelbyville, with military rites by the Shelby County Honor Guard. Memorials may be given to the First United Methodist Church Food Pantry or Save Our Chautauqua. Jacqueline Jackie Law, 43, formerly of Decatur, passed away on Saturday, October 10th, in Indianapolis. Visitation will be held from 5 to 7 p.m. tomorrow, Friday, October 16th, with funeral services beginning at 7 p.m. at Brintlinger and Earl Funeral Home in Decatur. Okay, we're taking up some of the opinion pieces in the Decatur Herald and Review. The first is their editorial of the day. It carries the headline, "Political Move Seems Clumsy." Contested elections are good for voters, so it's encouraging that State Senator Kyle McCarter, Republican of Lebanon, has decided to take on U.S. Representative John Shimkus, a Republican from Collinsville. Shimkus represents the 15th District 15th District, which spreads across 33 counties of eastern and southern Illinois. McCarter, who is about as independent as any politician you'll meet, has served in the Illinois Senate since 2009. At one time, he represented a good deal of the Herald and Review circulation area. Although we don't always agree with McCarter, one has to admire his willingness to examine issues and determine his own course. There's little doubt that it's a gutsy move to take on a sitting congressman in a Republican primary. It's also good that McCarter isn't afraid to remind voters of a Shimkus broken promise on term limits. In 1996, Shimkus and several other Republican congressmen signed pledges limiting themselves to 6 2-year terms in the nation's capital. Shimkus broke that promise, as did many others, and is now the longest-serving member of the Illinois Republican Congressional Delegation. Shimkus claimed that he stayed in Congress because his constituents asked him to do so. Still, a broken promise is a broken promise. However, there is one aspect of McCarter's candidacy that we find troubling. It's the fact that in order to run, McCarter will have to move into the 15th District. He's reported looking for homes in the Effingham area, which he says will place him right in the middle of the district. Relocating in order to run for office feels like a politician selecting his constituents rather than the other way around. There is nothing to prevent McCarter from this action. Hillary Clinton moved to New York in order to run for the U.S. Senate. Alan Keyes was not a full-time resident of Illinois when he ran for a U.S. Senate seat against Barack Obama. There are plenty of examples of congressional candidates who have had to move in order to run in the districts they've chosen. McCarter is acquainted with the area he would represent if he unseats Shimkus. It's also to his credit that, to date, McCarter has stuck with his own self-imposed term limits. However, the move toward migratory politicians is another step away from the citizen legislators that our founding fathers imagined. It's another step toward making elected office a career, although McCarter would dispute that is his intent. The 15th district is drawn in a way to almost ensure a Republican victory, so the primary will in effect be the election. It should be an interesting matchup, but we'd be more comfortable if it didn't require a candidate moving into the district. Okay, now some letters to the editor. This one from Edward Dawson in Decatur. Would you believe it's about Aldi? Common sense says Aldi rezoning wrong. I was let down by the Decatur Plan Commission at their September 3rd meeting. Taxpayers and property owners from different areas of Decatur spoke and presented common sense reasons against the rezoning of U.S. Business 51 between Ash Avenue and Oak Lane to allow Aldi or any business to demolish and relocate into a long-time established upscale neighborhood of Decatur is uncalled for. This will only increase the traffic flow in that area and make it unsafe for pedestrians and unbearable for homeowners to access their homes. It's not a good business decision or planning standard for the city of Decatur. It will only degrade a beautiful upscale neighborhood and lessen property values. Ash Avenue is in poor condition as it is. Increased traffic will further deteriorate the road. Repairs will be a financial burden on Decatur taxpayers. The Plan Commission approved the rezoning requests despite more than 600 citizens from all over Decatur who signed petitions to not approve it. The approval of this rezoning benefits the owner of the vacant lot on the corner and one small retailer who threatens to relocate out of Decatur. Intimidation should never be rewarded. The Herald and Review editorial recommendation to approve the rezoning was based on assumptions with no hard numbers of what the financial impact would be to the city of Decatur. Decisions should not be made on assumptions, but on facts. The city of Decatur is full of business assumptions known as vacant buildings. I hope the City Council will listen to their taxpayers at its October 19th meeting with compassion and common sense. This rezoning is not a good business decision or planning standard for Decatur. Again, a letter to the Decatur Herald and Tribune editor, written by Edward Dawson of Decatur. Our next letter is, let me find the signature. I'm not finding it. I guess we'll get there at the bottom here shortly. But it carries the headline, Compensate Victims of Gun Violence. Victim compensation refers to payment or reparations made to a crime victim. If people of differing political Surely they can agree that innocent victims of crime should be entitled to some form of compensation. In Illinois, the Crime Victims Compensation Act, passed in 1973, can provide innocent victims and their families with up to $27,000 in financial assistance for expenses accrued as a result of a violent crime. I have not heard any report of mass shooting victims anywhere in America being provided any form of victim compensation for simply being in the wrong place at the wrong time. If they survive their wounds, their private insurance or some form of government health benefits picks up the tab. If they die, the surviving family has to pay for the funeral. The grieving survivors also have to pay for any medical or psychological treatment they may need to cope with their loss. Various surveys indicate that only about 23% of Americans personally own any firearms, but I understand that we can't have stricter gun control laws because a small minority of Americans, something like 2% to be generous, belongs to the NRA, and the NRA can make sure that no congressman who votes for any form of gun control ever get reelected. I concede that the NRA is correct in believing that gutless members of Congress prefer its approval rating and its campaign donations over any moral obligation to curb or try to curb almost daily mass shootings. I suggest, therefore, that we can and should pass new victim compensation laws that would cover the medical and burial expenses of gun victims and that gun owners be required to carry insurance for that purpose. And okay, here's the signatory. It's Barbara Minich of Decatur. Our next very brief letter is signed by Mary K. Olson of Decatur. What is purpose of the no gun signs? What do you suppose is the origin of the pervasive gun signs with a red slash that are so prevalent? I'm wondering, and you should too. How can repelling a trained, law-abiding gun owner be a benefit? And haven't criminals demonstrated that they welcome the signs? Letter to the editor, signed by Mary Kay Olson of Decatur. Our next editorial piece is written by someone whose last name is Goldberg. He doesn't really have a name to his column, but it is run by the Herald and Review occasionally, and they picked up this one. It's on national issues. Biden run could even help Clinton. The scuttlebutt in Washington is that Vice President Joe Biden is going to throw his hat into the presidential race, which means there is at least a 50% chance that he will. I mean, when is the Beltway scuttlebutt ever wrong? Under different conditions, I'd guess that if he does announce, Biden has almost no shot at winning the Democratic primary, and that his candidacy would prove a gift to Hillary Rodham Clinton. Historically, parties don't hold on to the White House three elections in a row. FDR managed to do it, but he had special circumstances on his side. In 1988, George H.W. Bush became the first sitting vice president to get elected straight to the presidency since Martin Van Buren in 1836. Bush's victory, which was far from assured, rested on two pillars. First, Ronald Reagan was very popular. Peace, prosperity, and a victorious end to the Cold War will do that. Second, Bush ran against Michael Dukakis, a politician so boring he made Al Gore look like Shaft. In short, after 8 years of almost any president, Americans tend to want a fresh face. That's why Biden's entry might not pose a real threat to Clinton and could even help her. Vice presidents in general, and this one in particular, are ill-suited to promise change because they have to run on their record in the incumbent administration. With Biden in the race, Clinton could more plausibly sell herself as a change candidate. In 2008, the Republicans faced a lot of disadvantages: an unpopular war, the financial crisis, and a president with radioactive approval numbers. But one of the more underappreciated problems they faced was that none of the GOP contenders was a surrogate for the Bush administration. Vice President Dick Cheney didn't run, nor did anyone else who could serve as a Bush stand-in. This made it exceedingly difficult for any of the candidates to distance themselves from the Bush years. The eventual nominee, John McCain, had been a thorn in the side of the White House for years, but Obama still had no problem painting McCain as the four more years of Bush candidate. If Biden runs, he will be for the four more years of Obama candidate. There is no way Biden, politically or psychologically, could distance himself from Obama. But here's the problem with the theory I've just outlined. While Obama is unpopular with Republicans and independents, he's still hugely popular with rank-and-file Democrats. Even those who are critical of some Obama policies are reflexively anti-Obama. Moreover, the Clinton campaign has discarded the standard playbook and adopted Obama's. The New York Times reported in June that Clinton was abandoning a nationwide electoral strategy and opting instead to reassemble the Obama coalition. As potentially the first black president, Obama electrified voters in ways the first female president cannot, particularly when manifested by an uncharismatic woman who's been a fixture of national controversies for two decades. The task of reassembling the Obama coalition becomes harder if Clinton is seen as breaking with Obama and attacking Biden, Obama's de facto stand-in. Bill Clinton could probably figure out a way to triangulate between the pure left-wing change candidate, Sanders, and the pure Obama surrogate, Biden. But Bill was a very talented politician. His wife isn't. We're going to pick up an article out of the Los Angeles Times that has the headline, "After Cancer, Survivors Do Not Choose Healthy Foods. What's going on?" Surviving cancer doesn't always inspire people to eat healthier, according to a new study. In fact, it may do just the opposite. Researchers report that on average, cancer survivors eat a less nutritious diet than the overall population, including less fiber and more empty calories. Fang-Fang Zhang, an epidemiologist at Tufts University who co-wrote the study published in the journal Cancer, said the results came as a surprise. "Cancer survivors are usually motivated to improve their health, so I think it is remarkable that they are still burdened by a suboptimal diet," she said. Zhang and her colleagues compared the dietary intake of 1,533 cancer survivors and 3,075 individuals who never had cancer. The two groups were matched by age, sex, and race and ethnicities. The researchers estimated the quality of an individual's diet using the Healthy Eating Index, which is based on the U.S. government's 2010 Dietary Guidelines for Americans. Scores ranged from 0, which means no adherence to the guidelines, to 100, representing total adherence. After adjusting for age, sex, and ethnicity, the team found that cancer survivors had a lower mean score on the Healthy Eating Index, 47.2, than individuals in the non-cancer group, 48.3. Cancer survivors also ate less fiber than those who had never had cancer, 15 grams per day versus 15.9 grams per day. They also ate more empty calories, which means more refined sugars and fat. While the difference between the two groups may seem slight, Zhang said it is still significant enough to suggest that medical professionals who care for cancer survivors should talk to their patients about nutrition, especially since survivors have an elevated risk of chronic health problems. I want to emphasize that poor diet is prevalent in this population and the chronic disease burden is high, she said. A small change can potentially have a large impact to a high-risk population. Among those who once had cancer, older people were found to have a healthier diet than younger people, and those who had a college education had a significantly more healthy diet than those who were less educated. Current smokers had a worse diet than those who were no longer smoking or never smoked at all. The researchers also compared the diets of people who survived different types of cancer. People who had breast cancer had the healthiest diet, while those who had lung cancer had the worst diet. The study doesn't address why the diets of cancer survivors are worse than those who never had cancer, but Zhang said there could be several potential reasons. She said it is possible that people who have had previously been diagnosed with cancer had worse diets than the general population to begin with, although she does not have data to support that hypothesis. She also noted that cancer treatments can cause people to have specific food cravings or change the way food tastes. Those changes might persist long after the treatment is over, leading survivors to eat less healthy foods. Finally, she said having cancer can cause high levels of stress and anxiety during and beyond treatment, making it difficult for survivors to prioritize a nutritious diet. Ultimately, we need more longitudinal studies that can access diet post and pre-diagnosis to address that question, she said. Pardon me. In the meantime, Zhang hopes her study will help healthcare professionals make sure that nutrition is part of the conversation, not just for those who have been diagnosed with cancer, but for those who have kicked it. Well, we are out of time with the second half hour of news from the Decatur area for Thursday, October 15th. We had a little technical difficulties in the middle here. I hope that wasn't too noticeable to y'all. If we had a hiccup there, please pardon us and hope to do better next time. This has been Ruth McCauley reading with you today. It's a pleasure as always. I look forward to doing it again next week. And until that time, y'all take care.